You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPod listeners. Today we're talking about ageism, the way people get judged, sidelined, or written off just because of how old they are. It shows up at work, in healthcare, in politics, and in the public sector generally. And it quietly shapes who gets chances and who's ignored. In this episode, we're asking why age still matters so much in how society treats us, and what it would look like to value people at every stage of life. I will be exploring with two experts whether law, both on the domestic and on the international stage, is up to this problem of age discrimination. Alistair Henderson of One Crown Office Row is a regular guest on LawPod UK. He specialises in public law, human rights, employment and equality law. He's also a commissioner of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, where he's played a leading role in high-profile investigations. So Alistair is ideally placed to bridge the doctrinal nuts and bolts of the Equality Act 2010, as it applies to age discrimination, with our other expert, Nina Hjorhansi. Nina is a human rights lawyer and academic who serves as head of human rights advocacy at Age Platform Europe, where she leads work on the rights of older persons and the fight against ageism at EU and international level. She's been a key figure in developing the emerging field of older persons' human rights, building bridges between research, policy, and practice on ageing equality and non-discrimination. She has contributed to key international standards, including participation in drafting the Council of Europe recommendation on the rights of older persons, and she's advised bodies such as the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the International Labour Organization on ageing and human rights. So turning to you first, Nina, I just wanted to start off with your description of the 2024 decision of the UN to create an intergovernmental working group to draft a UN Convention on the Rights of Older Persons as a historic milestone. So what concretely has changed at UN level compared with where we were, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, so actually, to understand the historic importance of this resolution, perhaps one has to go way back, even before 10 or 15 years, because the first time actually that the UN started discussing the possibility of a specific instrument on the rights of older persons was back in 1948. So to understand the historic importance of this resolution, one would have to go way back to 1948, when there was the first attempt and the first proposal coming from Argentina to propose a declaration on old age rights. So around the time that the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights was being drafted, there was another proposal to include a specific provision covering older persons, but then that was again rejected because some delegations felt that there might be a need for a specific instrument covering older persons' rights. Now, it took decades for these proposals to mature, but in 2010, the UN General Assembly established an open-ended working group with a mandate to discuss ways to strengthen the protection of human rights of older persons worldwide and to discuss the feasibility of a new UN convention. Now, for over 15 years, this group has been meeting. There were hundreds of documents being submitted, written and oral statements by experts, member states, civil society, and others. And for many years, there was not consensus on the way forward. But in 2024, this working group concluded its mandate with a decision, including a list of recommendations on the way forward to address gaps in the protection of the rights of older people. And one of those recommendations was the establishment of a new UN convention. So the others had to do more with how to better apply existing global protections. The reality is that the only recommendation included in that decision that required additional decision, a resolution by UN bodies, was the establishment of a new UN convention. So when the Human Rights Council picked this up in 2025, because there was so much body of work done before, it wasn't perhaps as difficult to get the consensus that we needed. So this resolution was actually adopted without a vote. So there was no important, let's say, objection. And actually, 81 member states of the United Nations offered a higher level of support by becoming co-sponsors of this resolution. So it is considered important, although it took many years in the making, but it ended up with high level consensus and with high levels of support by many UN member states.
That's very interesting. So that's the general background. There's obviously a big pressure to get ahead with this thing. But can you just explain to us who are not quite sure how these UN procedures work? What are the main models on the table? Are we likely to see a sort of convention on the rights of persons style instrument or a narrowed anti-discrimination convention, something more programmatic regarding older people?
So obviously these have not been decided yet. So part of the process that is going to start next year will be to discuss this. So the first meeting starting in February next year will be discussing mainly modalities of participation, timeline, you know, how the process will work out. And starting from July next year is when we will be looking more into substantive issues and content. So there's still room to decide, let's say, on the conceptual basis and the model for these treaties. What I can say is that early on when the discussions around older people's rights started and even in academic circles and others, there was a conception of older age and of older people related much more to vulnerability, deficiency, weakness, and the need for protection. So in that sense, the first model that came out was much more strongly to children's rights, the Convention on the Rights of Children, best interests and all that. Throughout the years and with a body of work in the human rights practice, but also gerontological work that understands aging also as a social construction, it became much more clear that this is not a sufficient, let's say, outlook to aging and certainly not human rights based, because we need to step away from seeing individual weaknesses towards understanding what are the systemic failures, how society fails and creates barriers for older people's full participation, equal access to all human rights. So in that sense, we're looking much more towards an understanding of more related to what the model of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities would look like, which also builds on an understanding of disability as a social construction. The other added value of having the Disability Convention, which is also the most recent human rights treaty, is focusing much more on autonomy, on participation, and also includes a definition of people with disabilities that is not focusing, again, on weakness and deficiency and the impairment of the person, much more on the social model. So this is very much seen as a model. But having said that, because one of the key drivers of violations in human rights is age discrimination, the Convention on Discrimination Against Women might have something to offer there, in particular around aspects of substantive equality.
Thank you very much. That's a very global assessment of where we're going. I just want to focus on the Council of Europe recommendation, because obviously you were involved with that. And that already recognizes autonomy, participation and protection from violence, neglect and abuse, old people. I want to ask you, Nina, does this instrument go far enough? And where does practice show that a soft law recommendation like this is not quite enough without binding obligations?
Sure. So the Council of Europe recommendation is, you know, by default, it's a recommendation. So like you said, it's a soft law instrument. And also it didn't involve really any implementation process or any review. So I would say that even the awareness of this recommendation is very limited. In the beginning of its adoption, we did quite a lot of effort as civil society to disseminate the recommendation. But I haven't seen, I have to admit, even the same level of commitment from member states who are supposed to be, you know, bound in soft terms by this recommendation. What this recommendation includes is a list of good practices, but the list of good practices, you know, were pre-decided by member states themselves. This basically a kind of publicity of what is considered a good practice in the national context. So whereas it is a really interesting reference document, it is interesting because it also combines both civil and political and economic and social and cultural rights. The Council of Europe recommendation per se is interesting, both in the process and the way it was drafted, but also has its limitations. Firstly, because being a recommendation, it does not involve any new standards. It really just brings forward existing standards of the Council of Europe based on the European Convention on Human Rights, so civil and political rights, the European Charter of Human and Social Rights, which is interesting because it's a much more dynamic interpretation. So it is an instrument that is helpful in many ways, and it has included some aspects of participation. But if you compare the detail that you would have under needs and care to the detail that you would have under participation rights, you can see that there's much more thought on the protection and the limitation rather than how to enable participation, for example, in society. So it is referenced, but it wouldn't be the only, or it's far from being perfect in any way.
Can I just come in on that, Rosalind? I think my experience is that even if something is either soft law or even harder than that, but in the international space, it does eventually have an effect. But I emphasize the eventually, it takes quite a bit of time sometimes through at least three routes into kind of domestic law and practice. So the first is if you do have this kind of periodic review thing, which as Nina says is a possibility at least here, then that feeds in recommendations, criticisms, just awareness raising about issues at the kind of policy level because governments are engaging with the periodic review process. And so they're having these things kind of brought up and recommendations being made. And even if they don't get progressed, they're sort of in the conversation. That's one way. The second linked way is that civil society organizations, so particularly in this context, civil society organizations that deal with matters of aging, will pick this up because they're on sort of on the lookout and they'll bring that in through their campaigning and advocacy and so on. And then the third, and this is usually the slowest, is that the lawyers, like me, do eventually kind of pick up on these things and may try and argue them in the courts or argue them in disputes. Of course, that's quite indirect because it's not hard law that they can use, but it does eventually make its way in. It can be a slow process, but it does still sort of move the dial often or introduce ideas that weren't being discussed.
Thank you, Alistair. That's a very good perspective from a practitioner's point of view, that it's not nothing that's recommendation. It's in the background and it's there. This is really a question for both of you. The pandemic was a particular harsh window onto the way we regard elderly people in a medical emergency. And I just wondered, it threw ageism into sharp relief. What age-based measures during COVID-19 do you regard as the most emblematic of the human rights failures towards older persons? I mean, Nina or Alistair, you want to take that up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to jump in, but I'm very interested in Nina's thoughts on this. I mean, I thought the pandemic, as you say, Rosalind, was quite revealing in almost in two quite contradictory ways. So on the one hand, the UK and pretty much every country in the world took extraordinary and drastic measures to reduce the freedoms, to lock ourselves down, to massively disrupt society, to protect essentially our elderly, because it was by and large, obviously it's a complicated thing, but by and large, it was those who were older who were much more at risk from COVID. So on one hand, as a society, we decided we were going to take huge sacrifices to protect our elderly. And yet at the very same time, there were appalling failures to protect some of the most vulnerable. The most obvious one, I think, that strikes me was the way that we dealt with people in care homes. We had this dreadful situation in the UK, unfortunately replicated in quite a lot of other countries as well, it's become apparent, where we released people who were infected with COVID back into care homes or failed to protect the care homes. And so loads of people died entirely unnecessarily, far earlier than they probably should have, in terrible situations. We had legal challenges, there was a massive scandal about it. I remember it came very close to home for me. My grandfather was one of those who had exactly that situation, kind of locked down in a care home for the last year of his life, hardly able to see his family. And then, you know, it's awful. It sort of revealed both a desire to respect and protect our elderly, and then a real lack of care and callousness and failure to think about it in some of the nitty-gritty practical ways.
Yes, it shows both sides of the problems of the pandemic and lockdown. Nina, do you want to come in on that as well?
Yes, sure. So in addition to what Ali mentioned, I think it's really important to mention how COVID brought into stark relief the issues of ageism and age discrimination. So age has been widely used as a justified criterion to impose restrictions on rights, be it age-based triage protocols, be it age-based confinement measures. And also, we have also seen quite a lot of age-based hate speech in media and policy discourse pitting generations against each other. So these were not, I would say, issues that were caused by COVID, but they became much clearer due to COVID. So they pre-existed and they still continue after COVID. So the reality is that, and I go back to what Ali said, yes, that there was an intention to protect, of course, older persons amongst other populations group, but at the same time, there was a failure to protect and to protect in time. So to some extent, many of the confinement measures and all that were not applied in due time across Europe, whereas we knew coming from Asia and from China and other countries that they needed to be emergency measures applied quite earlier. And one could have imagined if COVID-19 had affected more children than older persons, would we have waited for so long to apply some of these measures? No, and it's not my opinion. I mean, the director of the WHO said that it was a failure of our societies to act precisely because the pandemic was affecting older persons more. So this was a systemic neglect. It was a form of ageism. So whereas to some extent an international human rights law allows public health measures to, due to public health measures and to public health interests, to have a derogations for some rights, this needs to be in accordance to law. They need to be proportionate. They need to be necessary. They need to be time bound, and they need to be non-discriminatory. And I think that many of the measures that were applied to the pandemic did not apply those criteria. So we saw, for example, a lot of what Ali as well mentioned, so confinement measures or the situations that we saw in care homes also to some extent, and actually to a great extent, affected the right to life, the right from protection to degrading treatment. And these are rights to which derogations actually do not apply. So according to international human rights law, there are rights which derogations apply and others do not. So when it comes to the right to life and to protection from degrading treatment, there are no derogations. So people should be equally protected against those rights. And older people have been clearly discriminated either on the basis of age alone or age in combination with other grounds like disability or indirectly for those older persons that where age was not the direct criterion, but, you know, in nursing homes, the primary audience, the primary target group of those measures were older persons. And the real situation was that we didn't have enough opportunities to challenge those measures because precisely both national laws, but also international laws, European laws, do not prohibit to the same extent age discrimination. And I can tell you that I've heard from advocates in the disability sphere that they were able, using the CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, to fight against measures that initially used disability also as a ground to restrict access to emergency health treatment. But they had the tools, whereas older persons did not have the tools, the legal tools. They did not also, because what our tools, what our laws say, what our policies say, what our protocols say are also deflected in individual behaviors. So also civil society did not claim them. Older persons did not claim equally their rights. Their families did not claim the rights. One could assume that if we had to confine children, we'd do everything we could to allow children to have access to their family in an emergency public health situation. But just because it was older person, we normalized the situation to a great extent that we wouldn't have had it happened towards another population group. So yeah, it is a systemic failure. And still today, we still lack the tools to be able to address such human rights violations in case something similar happened in the future.
Just moving away from the pandemic, again, a question for both of you. Do you think that this is such a difficult campaign to tackle ageism because it's not sexy? Those of us who are lucky enough to survive into old age, that's a lot of us. And as we know, an increasing measure of the world's population, it's not a minority issue. So do you think that that's part of the problem?
I think it very much is, Rosalind. I think for a lot of people, we've started viewing the question of how to protect people's rights and how to protect certain groups very much, either consciously or unconsciously, through the lens of a sort of critical theory where you go, who's oppressed? Who's the minority? Let's look after them and anyone else is the oppressor or the majority. But I think that's a limited and in some ways quite flawed way of thinking about things for all sorts of characteristics, but it certainly doesn't work for age because, as you say, everybody potentially gets older. It's less simple to sort of see the difference between here's the in-group, here's the out-group, here's the minority, here's the majority, here's the oppressor, here's the oppressed. And so it doesn't really fit that way that people like talking about these issues. And yet it's something that will affect, well, in one sense, age does affect everybody because we all have an age, right? We're talking mainly about the elderly here, but of course, there's also the young, there's the middle-aged. Everybody has an age. And as a result, you need to think about it in a completely different way. I think the more helpful way to think about it is, this is one aspect of all of us, of all of what it means to be human, and therefore one particular angle that may come into play in any particular situation about how to protect somebody's dignity, how to ensure that their rights are protected, how to ensure they're treated as an individual rather than stereotyped or seen as just how they appear or what their age is. So, sorry, starting to ramble, but I think basically yes is the answer.
I just wanted to add, because I think there's something important to say here, and of course there are several theories explaining ageism and why ageism happens and all that. Partly it is indeed it's more newer phenomenon, or, you know, traditionally older people were respected in societies, and through industrialization they might have lost some of their role in societies and so on. There's the fear of aging playing into that. But what I just really wanted to highlight here, because this is also a legal podcast, is that it's just the normalization of ageism. And this is not unique to ageism. I think that different forms of human rights violations and non-discrimination have gone through a process where historically they were not recognized or were not seen as equally important, or they needed to be spelled out more concretely until they became, you know, more evident and more visible.
Can I just pick up on, I thought a point that Nina made just earlier there as well is really important. I think partly the reason this doesn't get as much attention is because certainly in Western societies, or at least Anglophone Western societies, for quite a while now, we've obsessed about youth. As Nina said, traditionally, most societies, including our own, tended to more venerate the old. You know, that if you were older, you were wiser, you had experience. Often we did a particular care for our older people. And somehow we've lost that over the last few decades, maybe a couple of generations, and we tend to think that youth is the big thing, and we've lost that kind of cultural sense of we look after and we venerate the elderly. And I wonder if law follows culture in many ways, part of the reason why this has got less attention as a rights issue, as a legal issue, is because of that cultural shift.
I think that, Nina, you've said in the past that investing in long-term care and support for older people is also an investment in gender equality, because up till now, the unpaid care of elderly people falls so heavily on women. So there's actually a congruency in the interests of women and the interests of old people if we get this sorted out.
No, absolutely. I mean, aging has a huge gender dimension in many ways, in the sense, first, because women live longer and they are overly represented, in particular in the older age groups, so the 80 plus. So while we live longer, at the same time, we live worse. So we are more likely to age with bad health conditions, in disability, to be subject to abuse, financial exploitation, and other things. So definitely there is a gender dimension to take there. And like you said, of course, there are all the gender roles and all the gender inequalities that we accumulate throughout our lifetime. And, you know, care responsibility is one of them. Gender pay gap is another one. And they all translate into unique and intersectional aggravated forms of inequalities and disadvantages when we're older. So definitely when we're looking into human rights in older age, the gender dimension needs to be there. And what I just want to mention here is that when we talk about human rights of older people or human rights in older age, I think it's really important to not see of that as the need to make reforms or to make interventions just in older age. And I think the gender dimension, what you mentioned, is really clear about that. Because imagine that we want to solve the gender pension gap. Like, you cannot do that unless you change the situation of women throughout their lifetime. So you change the gender income inequalities. You really invest in care and you offer opportunities for women to either receive compensation when they give care, to have access to social protection when they become caregivers, to have access to support, to respite care and all that. So unless you make all those life course interventions to enable women to make those transitions without losing part of their rights, you cannot really solve the issues and address the human rights challenges we also see in older age. So certainly these issues are very much interlinked.
A really good point, Belina. I think there's also something kind of quite deep here about, as a society, we don't value care and we don't value dependence, even though those are intrinsic parts of the human condition. You know, we all start totally dependent as babies. We all end up usually totally dependent as older people. We don't like that because we design our societies around kind of the independent adult effectively. Whereas actually, of course, there is real value and dignity and an inevitability to being dependent. And I wonder if that's partly what plays into, as Nina says, you know, often it tends to be women who disproportionately do the caring role, and yet we devalue that. And often it's the older people who need more care, and then we devalue that and think it's undignified. And actually, there's just quite a significant sort of cultural shift we need to make to get back to the idea that it can be dignified, it can be intrinsically human to be dependent on others. That's not a bad thing.
So we're narrowing, focusing into domestic law here, as we're some way into this episode. Alistair, can you explain to what extent age is protected under the 2010 Equality Act in this country?
We have pretty robust protections against age discrimination in this country. So age is one of the 9 protected characteristics under the Equality Act, which means that all the standard forms of unlawful discrimination apply to it. So you cannot directly discriminate on the basis of age. You can't treat somebody less favorably just because of their age than you would another person. You can't indirectly discriminate. So you can't have a policy, a criterion, or a practice in place that disproportionately disadvantages a particular age group, unless you can objectively justify it. And to be fair, there are lots of exceptions where you could do that. We can maybe come on to that, but you have to be able to justify it. And you also can't harass somebody on the basis of their age, nor can you victimize somebody if they raise a concern that they've been badly treated because of their age, and then you treat them worse because of it. So the full kind of set of protections that apply to other protected characteristics like race and sex and religion and sexual orientation and disability and so on also apply to age.
And this is a very basic question, and I apologize for asking it, but the Equality Act applies across both public and private sector.
It does. So Equality Act basically deals with particular situations or actions in society. So it doesn't just apply to every situation, it doesn't apply to kind of interpersonal interactions, for example. But it does apply to several key parts of society. So it applies to employment. It applies to provision of services and public functions. So any public sector organization or any business offering a service to the public. It applies to associations. So if you have a civil society organization or any other kind of association of people, it applies in that context. And it also applies in education as well, for example. So in schools and colleges and higher education. Quite a lot of different areas of society, the Equality Act does bite.
And as a practitioner yourself, also sitting on the Commission for Human Rights, the Equality Commission, what is your experience? How has this come across your desk?
So I think for us, the biggest thing most recently, to be honest, was in the context of the pandemic. And we had real concerns about various things that arose in the context of the pandemic. We've mentioned some of them already, way in which care homes were dealt with. Also things like DNR, so do not resuscitate orders, being blanket enforced both on certain disabled groups and on older people. So those are quite stark examples. I think quite a big part of our work in the HRC has seen quite an overlap between age and disability. We've touched on that already, but that quite often the same problems affect both the disabled and those who are older. And you get, for example, social care. There's a real issue both in terms of the quality of the provision of care and the protection for people who are receiving social care, whether that's in a care home or receiving care in their homes. But also, frankly, and this is kind of not directly the people involved, but people who are actually providing care, there's real disparities in pay and conditions for the people providing care, which sort of goes back to the point I made earlier, devalues how much we value society caregiving. And there's real kind of discriminatory elements in there as well. So there's been quite a few different angles. Another key one that we've had a lot of look at, again, that's straddled both disability and age, is transport and accessibility of transport, because being able to get around is often a key way to kind of access society and its benefits. And yet quite often, either older people or disabled people struggle to access transport, particularly in more rural areas, particularly if they can't drive. And then a final area that's been a real focus for us has been access to services when there's a kind of digital by default approach. So big push of government for understandable reasons, efficiency, ease of access, to push lots and lots of public services into primarily online. But of course, if you're older, and that by no means follows that because you're older, you're not incredibly digital savvy, you may well be. But in general, on average, a lot of older people are less confident or less comfortable with accessing things primarily online. And you're suddenly shutting out quite a huge chunk of the population, the growing population, if you go digital by default and you don't provide either ways to access that or alternatives.
I mean, I don't count myself as a particularly old person. I'm in my 60s. But so often when I'm trying to park my car, I have to download an app. Well, what if I don't have a smartphone? I mean, this is something we're all talking about. But yes, that's a very, very strong point, Alistair. So, Alistair, can you give us an example of a couple of cases where age discrimination has come up in sharp relief?
Yes, certainly. So it has actually been dealt with by the higher courts a fair bit. One thing, of course, that's worth mentioning is that in certain circumstances, direct age discrimination can be justified, which is different to the other protected characteristics. So normally, the way the Equality Act works is that if you're shown to have treated somebody less favourably because of, for example, their race or their sex, if that's shown, there's no justification. You can't justify that. But that can be done in certain circumstances for age. There was a significant Supreme Court decision called Selden back in 2012 to do with compulsory retirement ages. And the Supreme Court kind of gave quite significant guidance on what do you need to do to justify that? And it's relatively limited. You have to jump through quite a lot of hoops to kind of justify something like a compulsory retirement age. You basically have to have a legitimate objective of a public interest nature consistent with the broader social policy aims of the state. And so, you know, there's quite a lot of elements to that, and there's therefore quite a lot of justification that needs to be made. That's a key one. I think perhaps a couple of more fun examples. It's worth knowing that the courts have been quite keen recently to make a point about the importance of avoiding stereotyping. This has been true on all sorts of things. So a very recent decision just from earlier this year in the case of Higgs, which was in the context of religion and belief, made the point, you know, you can't just jump to the assumption that because someone has belief A, that means they will discriminate against certain people. You can't make assumptions. You have to look at the person. And there's a good example of that in the context of age discrimination, a case called Matar, Imperial College Healthcare Trust and Matar, back from 2023. The claimant was a consultant in a hospital, and he was in his late 50s. He planned to retire reasonably early at 60, but he was very interested in a specialist registration, in kind of still progressing his career and doing a specialist extra form of training. It was basically assumed that he wouldn't be interested in it because he was in his late 50s. So he wasn't given the opportunity to do it. Whereas a younger applicant was assumed to, he must be interested because he's going to want to progress his career. And that was found to be a case of age discrimination based on the idea, you know, you've stereotyped somebody, you've assumed that because of their age, they won't be interested in this thing without actually checking with them. Another quite fun one, and this kind of illustrates the point that it's not always just about very obvious kind of age limits or compulsory retirement, things like that. A case from Northern Ireland from a few years ago called McCoy criticized the use of adverts that used, you know, this is the kind of language you see on LinkedIn all the time, kind of business jargon. It had an advert that said, "We want someone with youthful enthusiasm, drive and motivation and ambition." And an older applicant for the role, who was, again, in his late 50s, but had over 30 years relevant experience for this job, very highly qualified applicant, was unsuccessful. And he claimed age discrimination on that because he said, "You've inherently got a bias there. If you describe this role as being one that wants youthful enthusiasm, and then I come along as a 58-year-old with bags of experience and a lot of enthusiasm, you're against me." And again, he won that case. So it's a good reminder that, you know, in relation to age, as with other things, you've got to be careful about bias creeping in, even just the way you talk about roles.
That's very interesting, and shows in practice how it's absolutely endemic, attitudes towards old people.
So if I can come in and ask something, Ali, about UK case law, because at least there's an issue in European case law where we see actually courts adopting biased decisions, or at least part of the decision is based on biased assumptions. So for example, European case law, and I think you mentioned that as well. I mean, there's a certain level of justification of age discrimination, but in this justification, often there is an assumption that by default and uniformly, fitness to work declines in older age, which is not based on any scientific evidence. And often it uses a criterion saying that it's best to retire people at a certain age, like have a mandatory retirement age, instead of impose a certain test to assess their fitness to work, because that would be a breach of their dignity, but at the same time doesn't consider a breach of the dignity to, by default, consider that fitness to work declines with age. And also, while at the same time not being able to discriminate on the basis of disability. So assumption of disability or unfitness to work in old age is a justified criterion, whereas disability per se is not a justified criterion for someone basically out of work. So there are elements of bias justifications like that, or the court does not take into account in some cases whether the pension that the person receives is sufficient for them to have an adequate standard of living just because they receive a pension is sufficient. And if they needed to work additionally to have an adequate standard of living, they don't give them that opportunity just because they have access to a pension. So, you know, there's no consideration of adequate standard of living in the context of old age. There's European case law as well. This was in the European Court of Human Rights around women's reproductive rights, and basically assuming that after a certain age, after the age of 50, sexual and reproductive rights are not equally important for older women, basically assuming that reproductive rights are only important during the women's reproductive years. Do you see something like that also in national case law?
Yes, I mean, some of that has been grappled with. I suppose the difficulty is that there are just practical considerations sometimes where it's disproportionate or impossible to do a completely individualized assessment. Sometimes you have to have a policy to just make things workable. But the courts have had to try and grapple with exactly that tension, that on the one hand, you can sometimes justify taking a bright line rule or a policy approach because it's simply unwieldy and impossible to do quite the level of like individualized consideration of everyone's situation that might be more ideal, retirement age being an example. But then equally, they have tried to grapple with the fact that you do have to not have an inherent bias against, for example, older people, because you assume a lack of capability or a decline in function or whatever that's just not evidenced at all. So yeah, we have tried to grapple that. Selden is a good example of that, about compulsory retirement ages. It grappled with exactly that issue. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is that the Equality Act, so our domestic equality law, as I mentioned before, does have quite a lot of exceptions for age that don't apply to the same extent to other protected characteristics. Most of them, though, are designed as a sort of positive thing. You know, there are exceptions because they are designed to kind of go above and beyond, treat someone better because of their particular age. Whether that's at the lower end of life, so lots of exceptions about children and education, for example, to say you can treat children differently or better in certain circumstances because they're children. Or at the upper end of life, where, you know, you are allowed to, for example, offer particular concessions. You're allowed to give people discounts. You're allowed to give people better deals because they're older. You're allowed to have different rules for financial services that treat them differently because they're older, because they've got less time to live, but they might have more money and so on. There are quite a few, but then some of those are much trickier. And compulsory retirement age is a classic example. I'm not sure there's an easy answer, to be honest. It's been a tricky thing for the courts to grapple with.
Yeah, hopefully the UN Convention will help us with some of these things, because I think that where we see is that international human rights law, at least that I know best, but to some extent, at least some national laws that I also know are quite biased and they are conceptually limited. So we need, hopefully a convention can help us rethink some of these issues of, you know, right to work, what does it mean in older age? Because at the same time, we have the tendency to extend working lives, but maintaining mandatory retirement ages without necessarily allowing flexible retirements and things like that. Or, you know, right to education, what does it mean in older age? Right to independent living, what does it mean in older age? You mentioned intersectionality there, completely agree. There are so many intersectionalities and challenges that affect both older persons and persons with disabilities. But at the same time, there is a huge age discrimination angle in that there are distinct disability services, whether you acquire disability before or after a certain age, you're most likely to get into be institutionalized, to have less access to support, fewer benefits when you have care and support needs when you're older. The default is maintenance care and not really full support to participate in society. And even the existing instruments, what do they say? They say have live independently for as long as possible, which is a language that is only used for older persons. It's not used for people with disabilities. For people with disabilities, the default language is on an equal basis with others. So this is where, you know, there are biases in the law, there are biases in the case law, there are biases in the practices. So hopefully a convention can kind of solve this uneasiness, and I understand it's an uneasiness, and some of these issues are issues of social policy, and you know, it's not up to the courts to decide all of these things, but they can provide, I think, a higher ambition based on basic human rights principles, precisely because due to, you know, longer lives and higher life expectancies and all that, we have to grapple more with these issues.
Absolutely. I think that's the really kind of big ultimate challenge here, isn't it, Nina? Because we are aging as societies, and there's lots of discussion about how, oh, that's a real challenge. In some ways it is, right? It does bring new challenges. It makes more burdens on the state and the way that we set up our welfare systems and so on. But I think we also need to kind of say, but it's a huge opportunity, right? We've got people living longer. Let's help them thrive, right? Let's help them be really, really engaged, productive, fully participating members of society. Let's enjoy and appreciate and use all the accumulated wisdom and life experience that all these people have got. And I think it feels like our whole public discourse is mainly focused on the challenges of an aging society, rather than going, how do we celebrate, enjoy, make the most of this, and see it in a kind of positive light as well?
I think that's a very positive note on which to end, Alistair. Thank you for that. And Nina, we very much look forward to this United Nations treaty coming forward and forming a background to the way we think about this increasingly large sector of the population who are so-called old. So thank you so much for bringing your respective expertise to bear on this discussion. I've learned a lot. We've covered cultural issues, we've covered international law, we've covered domestic law, we've covered pretty much our own individual biases, and we're all going to get old.
Exactly. Hopefully. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a great thing. Yeah, it's something to celebrate.
Yes. Yeah. It's not something we should be dreading. Anyway, thank you so much both of you. That was a most interesting, wide-ranging discussion. And just a note for our listeners that the full case citations that Alistair has mentioned will be given on the blog post, on the UK Human Rights blog post that accompanies this episode.